Hi, I'm Pythian Priestess, and you're listening to the Devil's Music Podcast.
Pantheon Podcasts presents from Hollywood, California, the Devil's Music with Pleasant Gaiman. You are invited to join the Hollywood princess as she explores her lifelong pursuits in the occult, sex, love, and that sinful rock and roll. Ladies and gentlemen, step into the dark parlor of Pleasant Gaiman as she brings you the Devil's Music.
Hey there, this is Pleasant Gaiman, and you're listening to the Devil's Music, a Pantheon podcast. A little bit about me. I'm a punk rock witch from Hollywood, California. I've had a lifelong passion for rock and roll and the occult that started when I was a preteen. In the 70s, I was one of the first punks in LA, and as a teenager, I worked at the Whiskey A Go-Go, started producing shows, and made a Xerox fanzine called Lobotomy, which led me to write for every major rock publication you could think of. In the 80s and the 90s, I fronted three bands. I'm a best-selling author with 8 books out and more on the way. For the past 30 years, I've toured around the globe to teach and perform dance. You might have also seen me acting or dancing in music videos, feature films, and documentaries. Look for me in the new Go-Go's documentary. To find out more about me or to book a tarot reading, go to my website, pleasantgaiman.com. I'm really excited to be part of the Pantheon Podcasts network of rock and roll shows. Everyone here at Pantheon tells stories about the music we just adore so much, each and every one with a different twist. Find them all wherever you listen to podcasts, at Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Pandora, anywhere you get your favorite podcast fix. And head on over to pantheonpodcast.com to share a show with a friend. Or be damned to purgatory forever.
The sicky sadist who hides behind his police badge to commit crimes of violence against other people. Whatever role they're playing, these creeps are always the same. Because a pig is a pig, and that's that!
Hey, everybody, this is Pleasant Gaiman, and you're listening to the Devil's Music Podcast. Today, my guest is Wes Beach, guitarist for The Accidents, Wendy O. Williams, The Blood Farmers, and The Plasmatics. We kind of met on Twitter, so we're Twitter friends, but we haven't met in real life. And this, maybe we did meet in real life, though. We're going to talk about that in a while, or at least we were in the same places at real life, in real life, I mean. So anyhow, Wes and I became friends. And thank you for the rock, the Reform School Girls soundtrack that you just
got. Oh, cool. Glad you got it.
Yeah, because we were both on that record, and he just sent it to me in the mail today. Aren't you happy to know all of our personal business? With no further ado, here's Wes.
All right. It's an honor to be here, Pleasant. I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
Yay. I know. I've been wanting to have you on for a while, and it wasn't until we had our Twitter discussion the other night that I was like, I should go ahead and just do this. And anyway, so you're in Michigan right now, right?
Right, just the Detroit suburbs.
And were you born there, yeah?
No, I was born in Brooklyn.
Oh, really? I couldn't tell by your accent, because it kind of had that sort of Michigan-y twang, but now that you say Brooklyn, I can totally hear it.
Yeah, and I grew up on Long Island.
Long Island.
Yeah. Yeah, I moved out here in 86.
Uh-huh. So it must be nice in the suburbs as opposed to some major city. Like I'm sitting here right in the middle of Hollywood on Cinco de Mayo. So for anyone who's listening, if you hear any explosions outside, that's what's happening. Because we're in explosion season. I mean, and Cinco de Mayo pretty much rolls right into the 4th of July, which starts like the day after Cinco de Mayo, as far as explosions go.
Yeah, that Detroit's pretty much like that, too.
I know, huh? We're lucky that way, aren't we?
Yeah.
So anyway, let's talk about, before we start getting into all your bands, let's talk about your young musical childhood, or, you know, like growing up, what were your favorite bands? What were your favorite concerts that you went to? Or, you know, when did you know that you
I think, like, you know, millions of my generation, it was the Beatles on Ed Sullivan that, you know, got me started in music.
And, oh, yeah, I saw that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was a big fan of, you know, AM radio. Used to listen to that all the time. And it's just kind of funny coincidences and things that brought me into music. My sister used to take ballet lessons, and I'd go to this rec center with my mom. And while we were waiting for her, I'd be playing all the latest hits on the jukebox. And I remember I'm playing Jimmy Gilmer's Sugar Shack. I used to like that song a lot. And this kid comes up to the jukebox and he goes, "Where's the Beatles? Where's the Beatles?" And I'm looking at him like, "What are you talking about? Beatles? What's that?" And he's like, "Where are the Beatles?" And of course, it wasn't on the jukebox. But the next week when we went back, we go in there, and sure enough, on the jukebox was "I Want to Hold Your Hand." And I saw her standing there, and I played it, and it just totally blew my mind. Just the sound that was coming out of that jukebox, it just knocked me out. And yeah, then from there, I was, you know, saw them on Ed Sullivan and got into the British Invasion. And I took some guitar lessons when I was about 8 years old, and I totally hated it.
Because it was acoustic, right?
It was acoustic, and it was, you know, like my mom's friend was giving the lessons, and it was all folk songs, and I just didn't care for it at all. And then my younger sister, Laurel, she used to take classical guitar lessons, and she took flamenco guitar when she was in junior high. So guitar was always lying around. And then I played the saxophone in the school band.
Hot.
And yeah.
No, I played French horn in my school band because I liked the way it looked, but I didn't think of how impractical it would be carrying that motherfucker to and from school on winter days.
I always wanted to play French horn, but I played saxophone. I played saxophone all through school and through high school and college. I majored in music for a while until I didn't get along with the music department and bailed out of that. But anyway, so my sister was taking classical guitar lessons and flamenco guitar. She got really good until she got to high school and discovered boys, and she put the guitar down. So it was lying around the house, and I just happened to pick it up and start playing it. And a total number of, you know, just kind of synchronistic events led me into rock and roll. I managed to pick up an electric guitar and amp, had in the basement, and I was at work one day in the summer, came home from work, and I go down in the basement. I hear a guitar playing. I'm like, "Well, who's playing my guitar?" And I go down there, and a couple of my sister's classmates are down there playing the guitar. And I'm like, "What are you guys doing here?" My sister was nowhere in sight, of course. And, you know, they told me they were just playing around, and I started hanging out with them. And they had played guitar, and I started picking things up from them. And then at the time, I was going to college and reading Rock Scene and Cream magazine religiously, seeing what was going on the New York scene.
Yeah, and, me too. I nonstop. I knew who everybody was, like in New York and LA, before I ever even went to either one of those places.
Right. So did I. So finally, my friend Bobby Gervix and I decided to go to CBGB's, and we looked so out of place. You know, we were wearing polyester shirts and platform shoes. It was just so funny. We looked like we just had fallen out of Studio 54. So we went to see Television and Talking Heads. Now I knew who Television was from, you know, from the magazine. I recognized them, and as we get in front of CBGB's, Tom Verlaine standing in front of the club. And I recognize him. My friend goes up to him. He goes, "Is this band any good?" Tom Verlaine turns around and gives him the dirtiest look you ever saw. It was so funny. I'm like, you know who that was? That was the singer of the band.
Oh my God. At least he didn't say the television sucks, right?
Right. So I get there, was standing at the bar in CBGB's, and I turn around, there's Joey Ramone on one side of me, Patti Smith's on the other side. I thought I had died and went to heaven. And then, that's of course, so cool. The music was just so incredible. I couldn't believe it.
What year was this? Tell me.
76. Summer 76.
Oh, okay. Wow. Early. Good. That's cool. That's so cool.
Yeah. And that started my journey to CBGB's. I used to go there religiously, commute from Long Island, drive in there, and I'd go to shows constantly. And then we started writing songs and playing, put a little band together. Didn't really do too much. And then
what band was that?
It was a band. First it was called Dice, and then we called it the Magnets, and then it became the Accidents.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was going to ask you if it led to the Accident.
Right. And with the Accidents, a friend, Paul Sass, was a guitar player. And both these guys, Bobby and Paul, were just brilliant, brilliant musicians. And I learned a bit from them. And we would sit around and write songs. In fact, when we came home from the television show, we started writing songs. And I remembered like almost all the songs they played, and Talking Heads, all the songs they played, and it was just the sound was mind blowing.
That's so great. Yeah.
And it was cool. I liken it to like Paris in the 20s.
I liken all of punk rock to that. I say that all the time, and I said that to my mom during punk rock, and she just rolled her eyes at me, and I said, no, it's really going to be historic, and she just thought I was going through, in big giant air quotes, a phase, and I was like, this isn't a phase, mom. I'm sorry, I don't have phases.
So my mother was real supportive. She was a musician. She had played cello and piano. So there was always music playing in my house, so classical music or pop music, and I've always been melody driven. Even though I started out in loud, abrasive punk bands, I was always driven by melodies. And then once we got the Accidents going, we played around, locally. And then finally we got an audition night at CBGB's on a Tuesday night. And we were opening for this band, a friend of mine. In fact, our drummer was familiar with him because he was going to school in Dayton, Ohio at the time. And he knew the band and was telling us about them, and it was the Dead Boys.
Oh, awesome.
And it was like one of the first times they played CBGB's. And they were just mind-blowing completely. This was when they all had long hair down to their waist. There was no bass player in the band. They came out. They did Sonic Reducer, and the microphone wasn't on. Stiff Bader's was losing his mind. They played the whole song without his mic turned on. And then finally they got it fixed, and then they did the song again.
I knew you were going to say that. That's so funny.
So, that was great. That was like, just a Tuesday night. And, of course, we played the circuit kind of. It was Max's Kansas City or CBGB's. We just kept bouncing back and forth between them. But we just could never get that lucrative weekend gig. Hilly liked us, and they liked us at Max's Kansas City, where for some reason we found ourselves opening for all the noise rock bands in New York. We opened for Von Elmo and Mars and DNA.
Oh my God, I forgot about Von Elmo.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, which was kind of, all these like synchronistic events in my life seemed to lead me to where I am today. And, he used to come out with the chainsaw and, And then later on, of course, that became Wendy's trademark.
Yeah.
When I was in the Plasmatics, some weird things. Before we had a singer, we auditioned for the singer in Manhattan. So we went into audition for him in this rehearsal space. And while we're outside waiting to audition for the guy, I look in the window and I see this striking, tall, blonde guitar player. And I thought, look at this guy. and we're waiting there. And then the singer comes out, and like so often happens in New York, he ran out of money, couldn't afford the space anymore. So we didn't get a chance to audition. So fast forward, a few months later, and the Accidents are playing at this private party for some punk rock girl singer from England. I never even found out who she was. But we played there, and what was cool was I met a couple of the local kind of legends in the world of rock. Lester Bangs came to see us play, and he really liked this. We played the song Talk Talk by the Music Machine, and he's like, oh, that was really cool. And he later covered a Music Machine song in his band. But anyway, he was there. Billy Altman was there, and talked to them for a while. And after our set, our guitar player, Joe Katz, who I think you know.
Yeah, I'm really good friends with him. Or I used to be. I mean, I still could probably just call him. But yeah, we hung out a lot.
So anyway, he said there was this loft party downtown hosted by this New York band. I hope I don't offend anybody, but this was their name. They were the New York Niggers. I don't know if you remember them.
I don't remember them.
They were an all-black punk rock band. And it's funny, there was three bands called the Niggers at that time. There was two bands in New York, and there was a band in Philadelphia. So this band changed their name. They added New York to the front of the name to kind of differentiate themselves. So anyway, we go downtown to this loft party, and I remember walking around, hanging out, and I walk past this table, and I look over, and I see this tall, blonde guitar player who I'd seen auditioning for that singer, and he's sitting there talking to this other guy at a table, and I remembered him because he was so striking. I said, oh, look, there's that guy again. So fast forward again about another few months, and the Accidents are breaking up. And we're kind of going our separate ways, and answering an ad in the Village Voice. My bass player, John Carlucci, or John Carl, as he's known now, who's played with the Speedies and the Fuzz Tones, and he's currently a DJ on Lil Steven's Underground Garage. We auditioned for Helen Wheels. So we were auditioning for her, and the backing band was the Dictators. So I thought, then this is really cool. So we're playing with the Dictators and just going over some things, but she wasn't there, of course. We were just running through the songs. And nothing happened with that. We never heard back from them. So I answered Ed in the Village Voice looking for the world's fastest lead guitar player, or world's fastest rhythm guitar player, sorry. And, you know, that was my forte, rhythm guitar. So I show up to the audition, and it's the Plasmatics. Now, Wendy wasn't there, but when I go to the audition, it's in the basement of this rehearsal space in Lower Manhattan. I go in, and it's real dark and dank. And when the door opens, it's...
that guitar player?
Jose Funahara, the bass player.
Who was it?
Oh, it was Jose Funahara, the band's bass player. And now here's another kind of weird synchronistic event too that led me there. With the Accidents, one night we were rehearsing in Manhattan, and we're done, our time's up, and come out of the rehearsal room, and out of the other room I see this guy come out who I knew from high school, and he comes over, he says, hey, my aunt's boyfriend's band's auditioning at CBGB's, you want to go down and check him out? I says, okay, why not? So I go down to CBGB's, walk in, and it's the Plasmatics on their audition night playing.
Oh, wow.
So I go in. Yeah, it's pretty wild. So I go in, you know, see them. I thought the music was terrible. I didn't care for it at all, but the singer was just totally riveting. Wendy was in this one-piece leopard skin print outfit. She just commanded the stage, walking back and forth and belting out the songs. And I thought, oh, that's pretty interesting. And I didn't really think much about it. And then when I auditioned for the band, they were looking to bolster their attack by adding another guitar player, because at the time they just had the one guitarist. And sure enough, it was the guy I had seen around for, you know, the last couple of years, Richie Stotts. And while I was waiting to audition, and I had picked up their 45, I learned all the songs on their independent 45. And they kept playing the song over and over again. I kept hearing them playing it. I guess they were teaching it to all the aspiring auditioners. So I learned the song. And then when it was my turn to audition, I go in, and they showed me the song. I says, yeah, I know it. I heard you playing it. And I played it. And then I said, I know the songs from your EP. And they said, really? I says, yeah, you're gonna play those. I played those and duly impressed them. And then they invited me back two more times. And then they says, well, we really like you. We think we'd like to have you in the band, but you seem to have a little bit of a weight problem. At the time, I was working for the County Board of Elections, and I did have a tendency to overeat a little, put on a few extra pounds. So I went on this crash diet, eating nothing but avocados and black coffee for 3 weeks, lost 30 pounds, and joined the band.
Wow. That's great. At first, I thought you said a weed problem. Like, what were you passing out? And let's take a break for a little minute, and we'll come right back with West Beach.
In your monkey suit, you just look like a monkey.
Hey, here we are back. So what was the first gig you played with them? Was that at CBGB?
Actually not. It was at CW Post College out on Long Island.
And then was this in 1979, right?
Yeah, this is in 79. Yep, spring of 79. And then the next gig was at CBGB's. It was a weekend gig, a Friday and Saturday. It was the first time I ever played a weekend at CBGB's, which was really cool. And the band had already had a considerable amount of buzz. They were on the cover of the Soho News, and there was an article in Q Magazine about Wendy, an interview with her. And I remember I had to fight my way to get backstage at CBGB's. That first gig was, the crowd was so packed, there was lines waiting to get in CBs. And it was really pretty amazing. And I'm like, I'm in the band. People wouldn't let me get by. I had to fight my way through. So it was really something to be playing a packed house at CBGB's on a Friday night.
That's really cool. When I was in New York in 1979, I went there with Kid Congo, and I thought I was going to stay 2 weeks, and then I stayed like 4 months. So that was summer into November in New York. But I actually Wendy was working at the same strip club that I was working at on 34th Street. It was called the Wild West. And I saw her a couple of times, and I knew who she was, but a lot of punk rock girls were there working. Lydia Lunch was the one that got me the job there as a waitress. And then when I saw how much money the dancers were making, you know, I was like, I want to audition to dance. And then I was asking Lydia what you had to do, because I'd never done that before. And she was saying, you know, do this, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, just bring your G-string and stuff. And I was like, you have to wear these kind of shoes. And I was like, I don't have a G-string. And she said, I'll let you borrow one. And then she dug around and she got a black G-string out and threw it at me and said, wash it before you bring it back. And so when I went in there, like, there was all these like girls and, you know, beautiful girls. And this was pre-lap dances, you know, and we had to do B-girl stuff. Like, we had to get men to buy us fake champagne, which they thought was real. And then we'd be telling them stuff and like pouring it into an ice bucket, you know, just like in Sweet Charity or something. But anyway, so my hair was bright pink, and this was like pretty much that I couldn't get hired anywhere. So this was why I started working there. And I saw everyone else had all these, you know, like long Farrah hair, but then they'd go into the dressing room and they'd fucking whip it off, and they'd all have like insane punk rock, like manic panic hair, and, you know, that was really wild. And I remember, did you ever go in there?
Did you? Probably. I might have, yeah.
Because there was some people.
This was like, a pretty
Sorry, go ahead.
Pretty wild places.
Yeah. Like everyone's like boyfriends would always come in, or like Paul Zone was always in there. He would just pop in to say hi. You know what I mean?
So, oh yeah. I love the Fast. I used to go see them all the time.
I love them.
And Lydia Lunch. I'm a big fan of Lydia Lunch. I mean, I loved her stuff.
Yeah.
I thought she was great.
Yeah.
One time we went to do a photo shoot for Interview Magazine where we were on the cover, and I ring the bell to the studio, and door opens up. I go, Wispeach Plasmatics. She goes, Lydia Lunch. I was like, Lydia Lunch? I just couldn't believe it. She was opening the door. I don't know what she was doing. Just
maybe
let me
she was
in.
Just open it. Maybe she was just near it. Like, I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, I think
she
so.
She was
I don't
working
know.
For them or anything. I don't know.
I don't know.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
But yeah, I think our paths probably crossed a number of times. I used to go to all the shows and CBGB's, Max's, Kansas City, and all the other weird clubs around the lower Manhattan, the Midtown. You used to go see bands like the Cramps and the Mumps. And
I lived in the Mumps loft, like in their practice loft on Bowery and Grand. That was where Kid Congo and I were staying. And also like Lydia practiced there, the Senders practiced there. And then Lydia's other band after.
Yeah, the Senders.
Yeah.
The Senders, our drummer from The Accidents, Mark Borsett, ended up playing with the Senders for a while.
Yeah, I liked the Senders. They were great.
Yeah, they were cool.
In fact,
everybody in the Accidents went on to bigger and better things. I, of course, joined the Plasmatics. Joe Katz went to a band called The Ghosts and then went to Student Teachers and then to the Mumps.
Yeah.
And then John Carlucci went to the Speedies. And then later he played with the Fuzz Tones out in L.A. And Mark Borsett, he played with Karen Lawrence and played with the Victims before playing with the Cinders. So everybody in that band went on to bigger and better things.
Yeah, I remember. What was I going to say? I lost my train of thought. Woo woo.
And then you mentioned Manic Panic before. In the accidents when I originally joined them, the singers were Tish and Snooki, who founded Manic Panic.
That's so cool. I love them. I got to get them on here.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
What do you think? What was your wildest gig from those days, or at least with the Plasmatics? Because I'm sure those gigs got insane.
Oh, they were all insane. I mean, we had crowds that were just with rabid. We used to joke about it. We used to call them the Wendy perverts, crowding the front of the stage, trying to grab a Wendy. And one gig, a guy grabbed her and she took the mic stand and slammed him in the forehead, and his blood dripping down his face.
Where was that? Was that New York?
That was in New York. That was in a club out on Long Island. And there was another time, this little bar in New Jersey where the stage was behind the bar. So you're up on the stage and you kind of had to duck down or your head would hit the ceiling.
Was that
Maxwell?
And
I remember Richie running on. No, it wasn't Maxwell. Okay. It was just some New Jersey bar. I don't know where it was. Richie was dancing across the stage, knocking drinks over. He'd grab people's drinks and take a drink and then put it down in front of them. And that was pretty crazy. And another time, and we're playing this club out on Long Island called Spit. And Richie's grabbing the pipes on the ceiling, going across the ceiling. And he lost his grip and fell down and on top of one of the fans and got into a little scuffle with them on the floor. And there's all kinds of stuff like that going on. And I remember at CB's, one gig we were playing there, and it was really packed. And all of a sudden, from the back of the club, you see this kind of ripple going through the crowd. And I'm thinking, well, what the hell is that? And there were these two giant Hell's Angels with folding chairs come right up to the front of the stage, plop the chairs down, and sit down right in front of the stage watching Wendy. And I don't know if you remember CBGB's a couple blocks over on 3rd
Avenue.
I think 3rd and 4th, it was the Hell's Angels Clubhouse.
Yeah, everyone knew that. I'm telling this to the listeners. On 4th Street, it was the Hell's Angels Clubhouse, and that street never had any crime on it. And if you were, you could walk down it at your own risk, or...
And they controlled the streetlights. They could turn on and off the streetlights, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, I heard all sorts of crazy, crazy things about it. And then, Kid Congo and I would just sort of look at it and try to see if we could see bikes parked on it, or but we never went there.
Yeah,
like everyone was saying, don't go on 4th Street.
yeah, their bikes that were lined up, but almost like the whole block, they were just lined up.
Yeah, like a police parking lot, except with the Hell's Angels.
And we used to do this thing with the band. We used to call it the chicken gag. And we'd get these chickens from a slaughterhouse and they'd put these cages up on the ceiling at CBGB's or other clubs we played at. And at a certain point in the show, Wendy would take her shotgun and shoot towards the ceiling, and then they'd release the chickens, and these chickens would be running around the stage. The roadies would be out trying to corral them and grab them. It was just like total pandemonium. And Wendy used to like to think that we were giving those chickens a chance at stardom, having them come out on the stage. And we spared them from ending up on somebody's table, which I eventually did, because we'd have to return them on the following Monday after the weekend of the shows.
That's weird. One time when my band, the Screaming Sirens, was on stage in Huntington Beach, there was this whole sort of scuffle going on with a bunch of guys rolling around on the stage. It wasn't stage diving. And I couldn't tell what was happening. And so between songs, I yelled, "What the fuck are you guys doing down there?" And they were trying to stuff a chicken into our bass drum. And I was like, where did you get a chicken? And then just suddenly it wasn't in the club. I mean, I don't know if it was someone's chicken or if they found it. I mean, I have no clue.
And Wendy always talk about maybe getting some pigs to bring on stage. Or
yeah, what? Like pigs?
Yeah, pigs. But that never happened. We never did that.
Didn't she wind up doing like a lot of animal rescue?
Yes, she ended up as a wildlife animal rehabilitator.
What year was that, or when was that kind of?
That had to be like in 88, 89.
Maybe she was making up for her chicken sins. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that, and I thought that was so great, you know.
And when we were on tour in Texas once, and some guy write the scathing editorial about how we abused animals and were killing animals. And Wendy was a total animal lover, and you know, she would never hurt any animals. And this guy just wrote this crazy article, and we got a lot of bad publicity from that.
I think I remember some of that, honestly, but I do also remember that, like, that I knew that she worked with animals or wildlife a lot, you know, so,
mm-hmm. you know,
press is lame sometimes.
When we started out in the pre-MTV era, you know, people in the Midwest and the South, they had no clue about us. And, you know, we'd come to town and we'd just totally freak them out. There'd be protests and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah, you were like Satanists or something.
Right.
Or just immoral. Like when my band started touring in the 80s. And so I think, when was MTV? I think it was 83 or 84, maybe. I can't remember. But right after when MTV was a thing, we started touring. And we had gone to some places that weren't like all across the country first. And people would just look at us like we were like a zombie attack or something. But then when we made our first cross country tour, that's when, you know, people knew what MTV was. And we'd be at like a truck stop or something, and people would be giving us double takes and stares. And then finally would someone say, "Are y'all in a band?" And we'd say, "Yeah." And they were like, "I thought so."
Right. That's exactly the kind of reception you get. I mean, I remember we'd walk into a McDonald's or something, and all of a sudden everybody would stare at us. People would come out of the back to stare at us. You know, they'd never seen anything like that before.
Grab their kids' hands and lead them outside.
It was so alien to
them.
Yeah. Yeah, it was so alien to them. They just didn't know what to do or what to think. And another time we're in Texas, we pull up to this truck stop. And we had a black bass player at the time, John Beauvoir, and he had this white mohawk. So we go up to the truck stop door, and there's this big burly guy, just huge guy, standing in the doorway. He takes one look at us. He goes, "There's nothing in here for you boys." And we go, "Okay, no problem. We'll go." And John is like, he's a younger guy and a little kind of wet behind the ears. He's like, "Oh, no, no, I just want to go in there and get some." We're like, "No, John, you don't want to go in." He's like, "Yeah, yeah, I just want to go in there." We had to physically drag him out and say, "No, you don't." And those like kind of things would happen to us often, especially down south.
Oh, yeah, down
another
south.
Time we walked into we walk into a restaurant, you know, in our band and crew, we probably had about 8 or 9 people. We go into the restaurant, and this family sitting at the next table over, the father stands up and he announces real loud. He's like, "I don't have to be subjected to this kind of thing." And he takes his family of 4 and leaves.
Oh my God.
Hey, right. Yeah. Like, we just totally ruined his day.
"I don't have to be subjected to this kind of thing." I'm going to save that phrase.
And another time we were in Detroit, in fact, we stopped at a White Castle at about 2:30 in the morning in a really bad neighborhood. And our drummer, T.C. Tolliver, he was black and he wouldn't even go in there. He's like, "I'm just going to wait here for you guys." And, you know, we walk in, there's just total silence. So, you know, everybody just staring at us, you know, but nobody bothered us. And we never really had too much trouble. Although in a lot of towns, you know, the locals would want to fight with us because, you know, their girlfriends were attracted to us or whatever. And we, you know, made a big splash. So Richie and I were always getting into fights and people wanted to fight with us. And one time in Boston, I remember I'm sitting at the bar and my road manager kept giving me Quaaludes. So I wasn't feeling any pain. I stumble out of the bar and this guy wanted to pick a fight with me and I just fell into the gutter. It's like, couldn't even stand up.
Go ahead. Let's take a little break and we'll be right back with Wes for more touring insanity, more 80s tour insanities. Okay, here we are. We're back and we loud. So, and any other like gems like that?
Well, we always love playing in California. In fact, Wendy and our manager Rod Swenson, they loved California, and we'd always schedule tours and things in January and February, the coldest times in New York. So we'd be out west. And we kind of make our base camp at the Tropicana Hotel in
Hollywood. Oh, like everyone, yes.
And, y'all, yeah. There was so many colorful characters there. We met a lot of bands and things there and hung out. I used to hang out at the Whiskey and all the clubs down in Hollywood and just had a great time. Didn't seem like anybody worked.
Oh yeah, I know, huh? Everyone was like an actor or something that was working in a gas station.
right. See, like nobody worked, and there were all these crazy people around. And
the Tropicana Motel, for anyone who's listening, was like the Los Angeles equivalent of the Chelsea Hotel. Like some people lived there, like Tom Waits lived there. I don't know if you knew that, Wes, but
yes.
And then the Mumps lived there for months, you know, the Mumps and their manager, Joseph Fleury. But at the Tropicana, they, after a while, they painted the swimming pool black. And everyone's like, what'd they do that for? And my idea of why they did that, although I never asked, was I think they, because so many bands and people were having wild parties that all the lawn furniture would wind up in the swimming pool, and there was rust marks all over it because sometimes there'd be like you know how you just said the Hells Angels dragged chairs up to the stage in front of CBGBs. There was like chaise lounges and lawn chairs like just on the bottom of the Tropicana swimming pool for a long time. So I think the whole pool just got discolored and they just painted it black to sort of make it. We used to call it the Black Lagoon, but there was one crazy night when Blondie was in town, but so was a bunch of other bands. Do you remember anything like that from the Tropicana? Because there was like, I think no. The boys might've been there too. Like, you know, like that was like one of the wildest parties ever, like pretty much. Mm-hmm. Also, the Tropicana always had rooms that were called shorts for the hookers that were out, you know, there was a lot of female hookers on Santa Monica Boulevard then, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So were you?
Yeah, it was always wild parties going on there. Remember one time I came back to my room and I go in there and Chris Spedding is standing in the living room. And I'm a big Chris Spedding fan.
Of your room? And like just, in, of that like, suite? So he was just
of our suite, there? right in the living room. Yeah, he was waiting for a girl he was meeting. And she was going to meet him there. How he got in there, I don't know.
Was it?
I thought that was pretty cool.
Was it room 100A? Do you remember that?
I couldn't remember. I know it was on the lower level.
Oh, it was 100 A then, I'm pretty sure, because 100 A, like, it had a few rooms in it, and they, you know, it was like the Cramps stayed there for months. Levi and the Rockettes stayed there for months, and that's so crazy though that you walked in and Chris Spedding was just in your room.
Yeah, that was wild. He had his pink sharkskin suit on, and he just looked great. And like I said, I was a big Chris Spedding fan. I had seen his band play the day before. He was playing at the Whiskey, and it was great. It was wild.
That is crazy.
And then we played on one tour. We played the Santa Monica Civic Center.
Oh yeah, that place is great too.
Yeah, that was real cool. And some punk fan got on stage and was dancing on stage and slammed into me, broke the headstock off my guitar, which really pissed me off.
Oh shit!
But after the show, David Lee Roth came backstage to see us and talked to us and met him. And you know, he was this guy. I wasn't really into Van Halen at the time, but I knew who he was. And I figured, you know, this guy is going to be, you know, he came off as just like this big rock star and thought he was going to be a big asshole. But he was like the coolest guy I ever met.
He was so nice. And he loved
was so nice. Punk. Yeah.
He loved punk. He used to hang out at the Whiskey all the time and watch punk bands.
Yeah, he was a big fan of Wendy, and he was telling us all kinds of stories of the road and how to do things and how to, you know, promote the band. And he was big into merchandising and t-shirt sales. He said they made a lot of money on that, and he's like, your face on their back. So he hung out with us, and then me and Richie went to a Grace Jones show. She was playing at the Palladium, and we're sitting there, and David Lee Roth came over to our table, was talking to us. He invited us to a party afterwards, which was cool. We went to this party and hung out with him. And then he drove us, him and his, I guess it was his manager at the time, drove us in his car. He was driving his Mercedes, drove us to the Starwood.
Oh, I love the Starwood. You saw the Blasters?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Me too.
I'm going to ask you, was it the night that their drummer's hand was bleeding all over the stage?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, you would have noticed. I just thought that might be a synchronicity. This was a show. Yeah. Where, I'm not going to tell you the whole story of it, but he sliced his hand somehow on one of the crash cymbals, and it just started pumping blood, and everyone thought it was a special effect in the audience. You know what I mean? Like, which would be like with the Plasmatics or something, but not the Blasters. And then when the rest of the band noticed, like people were screaming, not like how you just scream because you like a song. And when they noticed, they just like stopped everything.
Yeah. So that was cool. When we, you know, well, yeah, I love the Starwood. I used to go see a number of bands there when we went to Hollywood anytime. And Rodney, we met Rodney, and he was really cool.
Yeah, and Fast Freddy was it? Rodney and Fast Freddy were the DJs there. And the Starwood just had, I started going to the Starwood. The first time I went was in 1977 when the Damned played there. Or actually, I'd been there a few more times, but in 1977 was the first time I stayed out all night. And then after that, I would just tell my mom I was going to the library, and I'd take my school books, including like those big notebooks, and I would just fucking like, I'd walk upstairs to the VIP bar and park them behind the bar, and they knew I was a minor, and I would just go and hang out backstage up there.
I think there was a lot of miners in the Starwood, right?
Oh yeah, there was miners in the Starwood, but I mean, the fact that you're a miner just putting your school books behind the bar and then not like getting served at the bar. I mean, I don't think everyone was doing that, otherwise that place would have been closed. But you know who owned that place, right?
Who?
Eddie Nash from like the Laurel Canyon murders and all of that.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, he might. I can't even remember if he's still alive. Hi, Eddie. No, no besmirching of your name intended. Yeah, that place was.
But yeah, we always had fun in Hollywood. And another time when we did the Fridays TV show, we met a couple of fans, and they took us out to the Odyssey.
Oh my God! I used to go there. Me and Joan Jett used to go there all the time. We got thrown out one time for wearing leather jackets at the beginning of punk because they looked at us and said, "You look trashy," and they wouldn't let us in.
So after we did Fridays, you know, this guy gave us all acid, so we dropped some acid, and we go to the Odyssey. We didn't know what was going on.
Oh yeah, and the Odyssey was a big giant gay disco in West Hollywood,
and we didn't know that at the time. I remember going upstairs and they're playing Gladiator movies, and I say something doesn't seem quite right here.
Gladiator.
I remember this girl comes up, gives me a drink, and it's like, okay. And I guess the DJ there was fans of ours. And when we went up and met him in the DJ booth, and he played one of our songs, Monkey Suit, and it cleared the dance floor completely. I thought that was pretty funny. It was too fast for them, so everybody stopped dancing.
That's hilarious.
And I remember seeing this cheerleader walking around there, and all these characters. And I really didn't put two and two together till we were leaving at 6 a.m. and the sun's coming up. And I see the cheerleader out front, and she's got a big 5 o'clock shadow on her face. I'm like, oh, okay. Now I know what's going on. Because I didn't have a clue up until that point.
Oh my God, that's really
cool. That was a wild club.
That was a wild, wild club. Yes. I could go on and on, but this is your interview. Yeah, I mean, like, I will tell you one thing, which is funny, and just everyone that's listening might think it's funny. Every second person you bumped into at the Odyssey, their last name was Bowie. Like, there was Kim Bowie, Kim Girl Bowie, Kim Boy Bowie, and then like Rick Bowie, and this one, but yeah, it was the Odyssey was a bunch of like, Quaaludes and poppers and underage drinking. And it was really fun. It was very fun. Mm. Anyway, we need to talk now with you about what you're doing currently, because we are almost at the end of our program.
Well, currently I still write a lot of songs, and I find that in my old age, I've really become prolific. So I've been writing a lot of songs. I've got a lot of things I'm working on, projects. So just trying to find time to do them all.
I know,
trying to work on a remake of a song, It's My Life, which was written by Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley. It was on Wendy's solo album. I'm doing a version of that. It's going to have Ace Vaughn Johnson from LA Guns.
Oh, I love him. He's great.
Yeah, I do too. He's such a cool guy. I heard your interview with him, and that was really good.
Hi, Ace.
And I became, hey, Ace, how's it going? I became friends with him on Twitter, and he's
really
cool guy. So, yes,
Everybody should be on Twitter. It's Rockstar Central. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah,
we don't need no stinking blue checks.
Because I find Facebook too intrusive, so I stay away from that. But Twitter's a lot of fun. I've met a lot of people on there, and I've done some podcasts from meeting people on Twitter. And
oh, you mean I'm not your first? No, I'm just kidding.
So I'm working on that, and he's going to have Time Down from Faster Pussycat sing on it. And I'm getting
cool.
T.C. Tolliver play drums in Wendy's band. He's going to play on it. So I've been working on that, and then I've got another song I'm sending to a guy named Bloody Mess for his 40th anniversary album. So working on that and just keeping real busy. And,
that's great. Not enough
hours. Huh?
I just said his name, Bloody Mess. That's great.
Oh, Bloody Mess. Uh-huh. And just not enough hours in the day to do everything I'd like to do. I mean, I hardly sleep anymore.
That's exactly me too. You know, it's crazy.
I get up at 12:30. I stay up all night and watch YouTube, check my Twitter feed, and play guitar.
I think I keep more nocturnal hours now almost than I did when I was a rock and roll kid. You know what I mean? Like, I'm like you. I'm up. Right. Sometimes I'll, like, my neighbor, who's like, she's like 22, like, she'll come home after her job, which is like regular hours job, and she'll say, yeah, I saw you were still awake when I was leaving for work this morning, because she leaves at like 5 in the morning.
Yeah, but I guess the older you get, the more you realize how precious life and time is. And just try and fit so much into the day.
Yeah.
And I listen to a lot of music and listen to, you know, Lil Stevens Underground Garage and some of the DJs on there. And a lot of good music. My friend John's show is on from 4 in the morning to 8 in the morning on Sunday, so. Tune into that. Speedy John show.
So, tell us all what your main inspiration is right now, whether it's music or not music. Like, what are you obsessed with right now?
Music. I've always been obsessed with music.
And anything besides that? Like, any kind of weird little fun secrets we don't know about you?
Well, I'm a big fan of girl group sounds in the 60s.
Oh, I love that.
Surf and hot rod music.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up on that stuff. And to this day, I mean, you know, I play loud abrasive rock music, but I love melody. I've always been melody driven. And I love, you know, the Beach Boys and four-part harmonies and the Beatles.
Oh, my God, I know. I taught myself how to when I was starting my band, The Screaming Sirens, I used to listen to the Beach Boys and or Jan and Dean or girl group.
Oh, I love Jan. I love Jan and Dean.
But I'd follow like one. I would make charts, and this wasn't music charts because I knew nothing about music. But I would follow one person's voice all the way through the song, and I'd be like writing with like a pen or a pencil of where it went up and when it went down, and then another ones that would be like a flat line or something, you know what I mean? And that was how I figured out how to arrange harmonies. Like a nut with like a pen and a piece of paper, because I was like, how do they do that, you know? So
Well, you listen to some of those Beach Boys harmonies and they really just bring a tear to your eye. They're just so incredible. And I love listening to demo recordings. I've got all these demo recordings and all these Beach Boys recordings are just the vocals.
And oh,
just
listening
to that with no backing tracks is just amazing.
Yeah, like they could have just done a choral group or an a cappella group even.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. And yeah. Then I collect records and guitars, and you know, you can see behind me some of my crap in my office, which is just crammed full of stuff. I can hardly walk in this place.
I know, that's like my house. My house is full of like costumes and like art projects and cats laying on top of every surface. Okay, TMI, right? No. It's been
and then, of course,
nice to talk to you.
Yeah, and then of course, you know, getting into all these the psychic world and that kind of thing.
Wait, you're in it in the psychic world?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, we can't go yet. Tell me more. Tell everyone more.
Well, I have like, you know, kind of a heightened psychic awareness that, you know, I become more in tune with the older I get. You know, I've always had this kind of ability since a young age, and the older I get, the more aware of it I am, and I see all these different patterns and things.
Yeah, when you were talking about synchronicity earlier, I should have asked you.
Right. And I was into that with Wendy. I started getting into that and reading about it. And I found that whole idea of synchronicity fascinating. And then seeing so many examples of it in my life over the years.
And me too.
Even going back and things. Yeah, all the time. And like I said, I see all these patterns and things, which is really weird. Like I'll see a number or something that'll keep recurring.
Like 11-11?
Yeah, 11-11.
Like, now. Look, see? And, I'm showing him my 11-11 tattoo for the audience.
Nice.
we're on Zoom and you're not. Sorry. No.
And then I see things like, and I don't know if you've picked up on this, but I've noticed that on your shows, it seems like with almost every guest you have on, they've been at some of the same shows that you've been at, and you didn't meet them there or weren't aware of that.
I know it's.
And I think that's the same with me. That, you know, we've been to many of the same shows and many of the same areas, and just really strange. You know, where I guess, you know, we're all interconnected on the astral plane somewhere.
Yeah, I mean that all of that stuff is so crazy to me.
Like for years, I never really got into astrology or anything like that until one day we're on the road. And my drummer, T.C. Tolliver's birthday is like 2 days before mine. And we're really close. We're both Cancers. And, you know, we have a real unique bond. We're almost like brothers. So I pick up this magazine, astrology magazine, and it had all these birthdays listed and different characteristics from that birthday. And that his birthday expressed him right to a T. It was him exactly. And then 2 days later, my birthday, and it was me right to the letter. And since then, I've kind of taken astrology a bit more serious.
Yes.
And it's pretty fascinating.
I'm going to tell everyone, too, this isn't exactly astrology, but not only is it Cinco de Mayo, we're recording this on a full moon, and there was an eclipse today. So that's always like really, eclipses are really magical.
Right. And the full moon, you know, as a Cancer and a moon child, I'm definitely feel and see the effects of the full moon.
Oh, me too. That's my rising sign, Cancer. Do you know what your other signs are? Like, do you know
what your moon sign is? I don't. No. I will find out, though. I have a cousin who's very big into that and wants to.
Yeah, find out, because your moon sign tells a lot about you. Like, that's why a lot of times people don't think that I'm they don't think that I'm a Pisces, because my moon sign is a Gemini, and that's someone that like talks a lot and thinks a lot and is noisy and loud. It's like sort of like I don't present as a Pisces unless you know about all the psychic insanity and woo-woo shit that goes on with me.
So my wife is a Pisces and my sister's a Pisces. So
oh, cool.
I'm quite familiar with the Pisces.
Girl Pisces are better than boy Pisces, I just have to say. Anyway, and so it was such a pleasure talking to you, and we will talk more in real life on the phone, but for you guys, that's all you get today of West Beach. But he's just great. I can't wait until your new project comes out. So I will, or you guys will, hear me on the next episode. And I hope everyone has had a wonderful springtime. And thank you so much, Wes. Mwah.
Thank you.
The Devil's Music is written and hosted by Pleasant Gaiman. Produced by Aaron Alden. All sound design by Jerry Danielson of Busy Signal Studios. And of course, is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at pantheonpodcasts.com. Our social presence is at Pantheon Podcasts on Facebook and Instagram. Tweet us
at Pantheon Pods. All songs can be found wherever you get great music. Please pick up these important and fantastic tracks. It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.